advice about how to put on, how to take off equipment, what other things are recommended, making sure, again, everyone's on the same page with the latest information.
The state outlines its Ebola prevention plan. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, October 16th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Kuniganuk residents break the ice for the village's last fuel barge of the season.
No gasoline would mean no hunting during springtime. I wouldn't have any gas for the winter.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
First National Bank Alaska, who believes that success isn't simply having an idea, it is knowing the right lender to help bring it to life. More at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
And by
ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
The state's Department of Health says there is not much risk of Ebola reaching Alaska, but they do have a prevention plan in place. State Epidemiology Chief Joe McLaughlin says few people are entering the state who have been in the West African nations where the outbreak is occurring, which reduces the risk. He says certain measures are already in place to stop the spread of the disease, like a quarantine area in the Anchorage airport. He says people traveling from West Africa are screened as they leave the affected countries. The state's head of infectious disease, Dr. Michael Cooper, says health facilities, even in rural areas, already have measures in place to contain infectious diseases like tuberculosis and measles. He says hospitals are setting up quarantine areas and the state will have rapid testing abilities for Ebola by next week. Cooper says healthcare workers are also receiving weekly trainings on how to deal with Ebola.
So there have been beefed up efforts on the part of CDC and others to put out clear, updated, and better guidance to hospitals, to nurses, and infection control preventionists about how to put on, how to take off equipment, what other things are recommended, making sure, again, everyone's on the same page with the latest information, but then offering more trainings.
Cooper says the problem with Ebola is it has many vague symptoms, like a fever, body aches, and upset stomach. The key to stopping the spread is for people who have traveled to West Africa or who might have been exposed to conduct self-monitoring and to be honest with their doctors. Alaska law already mandates that infections of this type must be reported to the Department of Health immediately. They will then work with the CDC to contact anyone who might have been exposed to the patient. The Seward Chamber of Commerce has been freed of any responsibility in the death of Mount Marathon runner Michael LeMaitre. The Seward Chamber announced an out-of-court settlement on Wednesday, which exonerated the chamber from any negligence in a wrongful death action filed by the widow of a man who went missing more than 2 years ago. Michael LeMaitre disappeared while running the rugged Mount Marathon race in 2012. His body was never found. The Seward Chamber organizes that race. In July of last year, his widow, Peggy LeMaitre, sued the chamber for $5 million, claiming race officials were negligent and claiming emotional damage to herself and her family. The suit was scheduled to head to trial later this month, and the chamber had filed a motion for summary judgment. The settlement avoids a jury trial. Cindy Clock is president of the Seward Chamber.
Well, I'm obviously extremely happy that this is over. We have changed a couple things in the race. For instance, we have instigated race previews. So what that is like practice on the trail. So people can come down if they're first-time runners and go with people who have experience up the race trail.
The chamber's legal counsel countered plaintiff's allegations, saying that Michael LeMaitre had vision difficulties, making it likely that he could not see the rock that marks the midpoint of the race. Chamber attorney Laura Axe challenged Peggy LeMaitre's accusations because evidence showed in 2009 Michael LeMaitre was involved in a dispute with his employer and stated that his vision had so deteriorated that he could only recognize part of a person's face close up. Again, Cindy Clock.
He never should have been on the mountain. He shouldn't have been even driving, you know, and it came out that he had filed a suit for discrimination against his employer because they wouldn't accommodate his disability, which was extremely bad vision. So, yeah, he never should have been on the mountain, but maybe that was one reason he didn't practice on the trail.
Findings that would have been presented at a trial indicated that Michael LeMaitre had never done a pre-race climb of Mount Marathon. Race officials warn racers about pre-race preparation at safety meetings. And the court had ruled that Peggy LeMaitre's claim of emotional damage has no standing in the suit. The two sides have settled for $20,000. Seward Chamber of Commerce will pay $20,000 based on an insurance company's estimate of potential court costs. The chamber has been exonerated of any negligence in the matter. A Fairbanks jury has begun deliberations for a man charged with making false statements about the 1978 bombing of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. If convicted, Philip Martin Olson could face up to 5 years in prison. The FBI says an agent interviewed Olson in November and January, and Olson acknowledged responsibility for the pipeline explosion on February 15, 1978, east of Fairbanks. The resulting small hole allowed 12,000 to 14,000 barrels of crude oil to spill before it could be sealed. The statute of limitations had run out for charges in the bombing. Federal prosecutors say Olson lied and said another man had assisted him in setting off the explosion, costing the FBI time and resources on their investigation. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Anchorage schools say goodbye to one of the district's longest-serving and most unusual educators.
It's a happy but sad day. I know he's old and he needs to go someplace warmer, but I remember him being there and I was in high school.
Alaskan News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983, on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
And by
the historic Anchorage Hotel, offering space for rehearsal dinners, engagement parties, business meetings, or social gatherings. A boutique hotel in the heart of downtown. historicanchoragehotel.com.
Mailboxes across the Bristol Bay region have been filling up in recent days with a 36-page annual report from the Community Development Quota Organization that represents the region. KDLG's Mike Mason took a look at the document for this story.
In many ways, the entire Bristol Bay region could be characterized as economically depressed. Much of the region has high unemployment, and the entire region has high energy costs. One of the few organizations with money to spend is the Bristol Bay Economic Development Corporation, which is one of the six community development quota organizations set up to serve Southwest and Western Alaska. BBEDC's annual report for 2013 was released this month and has been sent to nearly every household in the Bristol Bay region. Norm Van Vactor is the organization's CEO. He says 2013 was a year that included some significant challenges.
The pollock industry probably hit one of its all-time lows in terms of market conditions. The cod industry, specifically the longline cod and the midwater trawl cod fisheries, again hit all-time lows in terms of market conditions. And, you know, pollock and cod are a significant source of our revenue stream.
In 2012, BBEDC and their partners harvested over 56 million pounds of pollock. That increased by 2 million pounds last year up to 58 million pounds. BBEDC's cod harvest in 2012 was 4.7 thousand metric tons. That increased to 4.8 thousand metric tons last year. Van Vactor suggests that the market conditions for pollock and cod have improved this year.
There's a lot of good things happening right now. I mean, I hate to say this, but what helps us in the pollock sector is to see the European quota go down. Well, just in this last week, you know, the European quota that they announced going into next year is going to be reduced by about 10%. At the same time, the likelihood that our pollock quota is going to go up is significantly positive.
Every year, the six CDQ organizations get allocations of groundfish, crab, and halibut, but Van Vactor notes that BBEDC has additional significant investments in the crab fisheries in the Bering Sea.
We basically now own the vessels that our CDQ crab is caught on. In addition to that, the board and BBDC through the years has acquired IFQ shares on the open market. And in fact, in 2013, BBDC went out and we've essentially maxed out what we can buy in terms of IFQ, individual fishing quota shares of king crab and opelio crab.
BBEDC now owns nearly 5% of the available IFQ shares in those two fisheries. Van Vactor says that investment looks like it might pay off in the short term.
So in 2013, one of the big things that BBEDC did was buy a significant amount of additional crab. So especially in light of the recent significant increase in the quota, you know, that investment last year really looks golden.
The quota of Bristol Bay Red King Crab is up 16% compared to last year, and the Opelio quota is up 25%. The King and Snow Crab fisheries opened up Wednesday. The BBEDC 2013 annual report has been mailed to households across the region, and it can be found on the organization's website. In Dillingham, I'm Mike Mason.
Early or absentee voting begins Monday, October 20th for those who want to cast their ballots before the general election on November 4th. Voting officials say language assistance is available at the absentee voting location at the city clerk's office in Bethel. There are currently two YUPIC proficient employees at the city office who are able to assist by explaining the ballots in YUPIC. Another option for language assistance is for voters to bring a person of their choice to translate the ballots and voting information for them. Residents from the coastal village of Koniginuk in southwest Alaska rallied against nature to clear the way for a barge carrying a load of heating fuel and gasoline earlier this week. As KYUK's Charles Enoch explains, freeze-up has already started along the coast.
40 or so community members broke the river ice by lining up 5 boats they used as a makeshift icebreaker. It took more than 24 hours to break trail so a barge could reach the local gas station with the delivery. Koniginuk resident Roderick Phillip was a part of the effort that had residents working from Sunday evening to Monday afternoon. He says it was
cold and windy. It was frozen pretty good. It had 3 inches of ice. We used Lund boats. Majority of the boats were Lunds, and there was like 10 four-wheelers lined up in the river just to light up the river. So the boats could see.
Phillip says the broken ice also presented some hazards. The Intrepid crew lost a few outboard propellers to the ice, also dealing damage to many of the lower units. Jerry Ivan manages the local tribal trading post, the Kamichtalik store. In late September, he says they realized they wouldn't have enough fuel to last through the winter, so they ordered more from a distributor in Anchorage. Weather delays and freeze-up looked as if they would prevent the delivery on Sunday.
There was a north wind for a long time, so the barge couldn't make the delivery. Then the river started freezing. Our elders asked for help, so our corporation began by providing fuel for the small boats we used to break the ice.
Koniginuk is situated right along the coast, 30 miles from the mouth of the Kuskokwim River, and is no stranger to high waves during the windy fall season. Cold weather came early this year, and Phillip says without the vital fuel delivery, Koniginuk would have effectively shut down.
No gasoline would mean no hunting during springtime, or even I wouldn't have any gas for the winter. Our main source of heat is diesel fuel.
With no nearby source of firewood, residents also use gas to travel to the Kuskokwim 50 miles away, or even to the Yukon for bigger logs, well over 100 miles away to get wood for their steam baths. The barge was able to leave safely Tuesday night, thanks to the community keeping the river ice flowing. For now, Koniginuk residents are focusing on getting nutrition from the Bering Sea before the surrounding sea freezes over. In Bethel, I am Charles Enoch.
For several decades, the United States Navy and other branches of the military have performed a series of training exercises in the Gulf of Alaska during the spring and summer months. The Navy is required to file an Environmental Impact Statement, or EIS, which needs to be updated every 5 years. The public comment period for the latest supplemental EIS closes next week. These exercises are conducted in some of Alaska's key fish habitats, so environmental concerns have been raised. KCHU's Marsha Lynn has more.
My first question is, why has the Navy chosen this location?
The primary reason we're looking at the Gulf of Alaska is to be able to do joint training. So I'm sure you've heard of the Northern Edge exercise. It's a very large joint exercise, you know, between U.S. Armed Forces. So we've had Army and Air Force and Coast Guard and Navy, as well as the state and other federal and local agencies, as well as some non-governmental organizations that are involved in this.
This is Leanne Nakahara, Public Affairs Officer for the Navy's Northwest Region. She says although other military exercises are done off the coasts of California and Hawaii, the colder and rougher Alaskan waters are more challenging. But the area they've chosen encompasses four different seamounts in the Gulf of Alaska.
Within their map of the training area, there are actually designated areas of essential fish habitat for all five species of Pacific salmon. So that's right, they want to conduct these training exercises in essential fish habitat.
This is Emily Stolarczyk, program manager for the Cordova-based Iyak Preservation Council, whose mission is to protect the Iyak culture of the Copper River Delta and Alaska's wild salmon habitat. Stolarczyk is concerned about how debris left on the ocean floor will affect fish populations.
They are asking for permits to be able to explode real bombs, use real missiles, real torpedoes, naval gun shells, the heavy duck guns, and do two large carrier strikes, so basically exploding really big ships and sinking them.
The project manager for the Gulf of Alaska EIS is Commander Alex Stone of the Navy's Pacific Fleet. He says the effects on fish are negligible.
We haven't seen really any impacts on fish populations as a result of our activities. If anything, a small number of fish could be affected locally, but we haven't seen any kind of like long-term impacts to fisheries. Our activities generally are, you know, very compatible with active fisheries, and we have active fisheries in a lot of the places where we do training year-round.
But Stolarczyk maintains it's more difficult to assess how fish are harmed by either debris or the use of sonar than it is for marine mammals.
Unfortunately, because fish are harder to track and they're harder to study than marine mammals, there has been very few studies on the effects that human-generated sound may have on fish. So they just don't know.
Information about marine mammal sonar interaction is readily available, says Stone.
A tremendous amount of studies have been done. It's definitely an area where the Navy has invested a huge amount of research in. Marine mammals can definitely be affected by sonar if they're very close to where the sonar is operating.
He says this is how the Navy handles the problem.
If there are marine mammals close to where the sonar is operating in that area that could be harmful, we either power down the sonar to a lower level, or if they're really close, then we turn the sonar off altogether.
One of the main reasons for doing a supplemental EIS every 5 years is to ensure that the National Marine Fisheries Service keeps issuing the permits needed for these training exercises to continue. Part of that process is factoring in comments from the public. Stolarczyk says one of the best ways for people to get their arms around this very complicated issue is to do some research.
I would encourage everybody that's interested to go on that website and spend some time, read it, look at what they're asking for, look at the alternatives, and read their EIS, the supplemental EIS, their scoping, their intent.
The complete draft SEIS and a wealth of other information on the issue can be found on the website www.goaeis.com. The public comment period ends on Monday, October 20th, so there's still time to offer comments online at that web address. In Valdez, I'm Marsha Lynn.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Premier Dental Group, offering restorative, preventive, and cosmetic dentistry with three offices, two in Anchorage and one in Wasilla. Description of services at smilealaska.com. And by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, Alaska's pipeline to the future, delivering oil today, sustaining operations for tomorrow.
Want to know more about how you and your family may get help buying health care coverage or avoid a tax penalty? Go to getcoveredak.org or call 211. This message sponsored by the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, a nonprofit health organization.
At a special meeting this month, Unalaska's school board approved a policy they hope they never have to use, one that tells teachers what to do if a student becomes violent or out of control. As KUCB's Annie Ropeek reports, it's part of a new state law banning what's known as restraint and seclusion.
The law prohibits teachers from doing things like handcuffing, drugging, or isolating a student who's causing a disruption. It asks schools to train teachers on using safer methods, and it says districts have to pass a policy on crisis response by this week. The Association of Alaska School Boards developed some basic language that meets the state's standards. That's what Unalaska School Board considered and adopted at a recent meeting. Superintendendent John Conwell explains.
It's basically telling us we can't physically restrain a student with a device.
Cannot.
Or they can't lock them in a room and leave them there without observing them. And again, it's something we have never allowed here.
Unalaska School Board Chairman Abner Hoag, who's also the town's fire chief, says the new policy makes the ban on those tactics explicit. And he says it gives them guidelines on when and how teachers can use other methods.
Similar to a police use of force policy or any of those sorts of things.
Superintendent Conwell says Unalaska's teachers have always been trained to use physical contact in emergencies, like by holding on to a child who was about to run into the road or hurt someone. Conwell says he's never seen any incidents like that during his 18 years in the district. But until now, districts around the state haven't had a uniform policy for addressing those situations. State Representative Charisse Millette, an Anchorage Republican who proposed the new law, wanted to change that, creating statewide standards for teacher training, definitions of different tactics, and notification of parents after an incident. Her staffer, Aki Galopsis, explained on the House floor in February.
Due to a lack of statewide policies and guidelines, there is a patchwork at play in which a student can travel from one district to another, where those guidelines can shift from having notification required of the parents to no notification of the parents being required at all, to there being no requirement potentially for personnel to be trained, and for no definitions as to what constitutes the physical restraint of a student or the secluding of a student.
Now, the last missing piece is the trainings that teachers in Unalaska and around the state will need to comply with the new law. The state is set to finalize its criteria for those trainings later this year, which will let Unalaska school boards start planning on how to put their new policy into practice. In Unalaska, I'm Annie Ropeek.
The Anchorage School District recently said goodbye to one of its longest-serving and perhaps most unusual educators. As KSKA's Zechariah Hughes reports, the departure leaves the district with a gap not likely to soon be filled.
Oh, that's part of his, that's the under of his shawl.
Last Friday, in the carpeted basement of the chalet at Russian Jack Park, a group of kids and their parents gathered to bid farewell to a beloved classroom instructor.
People just call him Tortoise. And his real name is Tort.
A Sonoran desert tortoise called Tort by those closest to him.
Our classroom tortoise has been in the Anchorage School District at three different schools. He was at Chugach Optional with his first owner, Betty McCormick.
That's Carrie Reardon, who inherited Tort from McCormick and has been his keeper at the King Career Center for almost three decades since in the early education program.
It's a very unique program because we have the high school students and the preschool population and their families, so it's kind of a multi-generational educational experience. And as you saw, some of our students come back as parents.
One such parent at the retirement party was Crystal Bukala, who brought her daughter Mia, a recent daycare attendee in Tort's classroom, to say goodbye.
It's a happy but sad day. I know he's old and he needs to go someplace warmer, but I remember him being there, and I was in high school 15 years ago, so he's been there forever.
Bukala's family had also volunteered to take Tort during school breaks and summer vacations, which, as Mia explained, had a wide range of educational and cognitive social benefits.
It was good. It was super fun.
The feeding, weekend check-ins, and host of extra chores that are part and parcel to pet ownership are one of the main reasons less and less classrooms have pets today. Reardon says that's a shame since they're such good teaching tools. They're an ever-present hands-on biology lesson They also help teach the basics of caretaking, which is part of why Tort stuck around the early ed program for so long. But Reardon says the benefits of pet pedagogy go even deeper.
Especially early childhood classroom, where children are just beginning to develop empathetic skills and being able to look at things from another perspective or point of view. And so pets provide that opportunity, especially for young children when they're so excited about everything and everything's, and you saw them when they were with the tortoise, they looking at his eyes and his nails and, you know, how does he do this and why does he do this?
In keeping with broader demographic trends, Tort will be leaving the life he made for himself in the cold north to retire in Arizona. Specifically to the tortoise adoption program at the Arizona Sonora Desert Museum, something like a free-range interactive zoo mixed with a reptilian retirement village. It's a bit of a full circle, since Betty McCormick, the original early ed teacher at King Career, came from the same area.
And she was the one responsible for bringing the tortoises to Alaska. She grew up in the Sonoran Desert.
Tort has been watched over and hand-fed his whole life, and no one is sure if he'll take to unfettered life out in the expanses of desert with other middle-aged turtles instead of human toddlers. But Reardon says if he's having trouble adjusting, the museum's lead herpetologist will help adopt him into a nice family in nearby Tucson, since he could live as long as another half century. That's the plan Reardon and McCormick came up with together. However, Reardon will have to carry the plan out by herself. McCormick, her mentor, passed away this summer.
That is why it meant so much to me to do this part of it, and to Betty too. She was very excited about this and really worked with me on what we thought would be the best ending for him. And I was looking forward to her doing it with me, but I know she'll be there in spirit.
So, after 3 decades, Tort is finally saying goodbye to Alaska, even doing it in style. Reardon was able to talk the airlines into letting her take Tort as a carry-on, stuffed under a first-class seat inside what looks like a regular pet carrier, but weighs 17 pounds. For KSKA, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Ann Hillman, Ellen Lockyer, and Zachariah Hughes in Anchorage, Mike Mason in Dillingham, Charles Enoch in Bethel, Marsha Lynn in Valdez, and Annie Ropeek in Unalaska. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
BP Alaska, committed to the state of Alaska through investment, production, and jobs for future generations of Alaskans. More at alaska.bp.com.
And by
Nana Regional Corporation and Tech Alaska, celebrating 25 years of resource development and partnership at the Red Dog Mine. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports and provide services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska. When passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. Safety information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
From resource issues to recreational activities, APRN brings you the up-to-date information you need for life in Alaska.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.